Thanks for pressing play. If you love the serendipitous magic that can only occur in a real conversation, you're in the right place. This is Christopher Lockhead, Follow Your Different, the number one real dialogue podcast for business leaders, entrepreneurs, and category designers with a different mind. We're joined again by our dear friend and multi-time guest, Kevin Maney. Besides writing a ton of books, as well as co-authoring Play Bigger with Chris, Kevin is also the co-founder of Category Design Advisors. In this episode, we hear the firsthand stories behind the stories from Kevin's new novel, Red Bottom Line. This is a fascinating episode about the shocking missed opportunities for innovation after the fall of the Soviet Union, as experienced by Kevin when he was a young USA Today reporter. From the optimism of Gorbachev's era to the disillusionment under Putin, Chris and Kevin also explore Russia's technological transformation, societal issues, and geopolitical impact. This is a conversation you won't hear anywhere else, so buckle up. Before we begin, I need to take a quick second to tell you about the Category Pirates newsletter. If you're an entrepreneur or marketer that's tired of just competing, then become a Category Pirate and design your own uncharted market. The Category Pirates newsletter is your compass through the untamed waters of innovation. Learn from legendary captains of category design how to frame, name, and claim new categories. Hoist your sails towards undiscovered riches. Subscribe today at CategoryPirates.com and join the crew dominating entirely new markets. Now, as Joey Ramone said, hey ho, let's go.
So, Kev, I've been so much looking forward to this conversation.
Me too. We have dueling guitars in our backgrounds.
Right? You got to have guitars. Like, even if you don't really play, I mean, you know, I just kind of make a noise. But they're, once you realize they're guitars and they're pieces of art.
They are. Absolutely.
Yep. Yeah, they make me happy, right? Yeah. Guitars make you happy.
They do.
Just seeing them. Yeah. So, I've been thinking about this a lot. So maybe start here. When was the first time you went to Russia and why did you go?
Well, this conversation is spurred on by the fact that I have this novel coming out called Red Bottom Line that's set in Moscow in around 1991. But that all comes out of the fact that I was actually covering the breakup of the Soviet Union for USA Today as a journalist from like the late, I can't remember when I first went, 87, 88, through about 1992, 93. And there is a story behind why I first went. So I was watching, it was when, Mikhail Gorbachev was the premier. He started to loosen things with these glasnost and perestroika. You remember some of these things were going on.
And there was so much hope, I remember.
There was so much hope.
Time.
And he was, we were all watching this in the West going like, oh my God, maybe, you know, this can actually, the Cold War can actually fizzle out and we can, you know.
Well, and Gorbachev was an inspiring guy. Like I think he was inspiring to Russians. The Russians I've spoken to about it, obviously I wasn't there and I'm not Russian, but. And he sure as hell was inspiring to us and many in the Western world that
right.
A whole new thing could be possible for everybody.
So I was watching this starting to happen, and USA Today didn't have anybody stationed over in Moscow or anything like that. And the trigger ended up being that I saw some news item or something somewhere that there was going to be the first ever trade show in Russia, in Moscow, by U.S. companies like Procter & Gamble and Colgate and those kinds of companies, basically just showing consumer products like toothpaste and deodorant and stuff like that, which the Russian population mostly did not have. And I thought this would be a great way to, like, you know, get kind of involved in this story. So I proposed to my editors that I go over and primarily cover this event. And, you know, and then try to find some other interviews and things, you know, other stories to do while I was there. So, in fact, they ended up saying, yes, I could go do this.
Were a lot of Americans at this point flying to Moscow? And
no, it was really difficult.
It was very difficult, right? There were hoops?
You had to go through hoops. You had to go through hoops to get, you know, to get in, you know, invited by a business or somebody in the government in Moscow.
So it's not like getting on a Southwest flight in America for an hour and a half and going to Palm Springs or I don't know where.
Yeah, I had to fly to Helsinki and then catch an Aeroflot flight to Moscow because there weren't that many U.S. airlines flying into directly into Moscow. Maybe none. I can't remember.
And without your journalist credentials, there's probably much more difficult to get.
Yeah, probably. Yes.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and it was crazy because like, something I refer to, for instance, in the novel and the setting is that like, there were very few phone lines connecting Russia to America going across the ocean. So here's what if I landed in Moscow and I wanted to let my then wife know, what I had to do was pick up a phone and call an operator and ask to make a call to America. And they would tell me that they'll call me back at midnight, maybe like 6 hours from now, when the first line opened up that I could actually make that call. So I'd have to wait by my phone and the operator would call me back.
And this is the late 80s.
This is the late 80s. This is like 1988.
Yeah.
And I mean, stuff like
that. And how old are you roughly at the time?
What was I? I was 28, 29.
Yeah. Like okay. That. Perfect. Keep going.
And you know, and by the way, my first trip over, my luggage got lost. So for the first couple of days, I didn't get my luggage for a couple of days. And normally, you land somewhere, your luggage is lost, you need some clothes for some business meetings, you go to a store.
Just go right on over to Nordy's or Macy's or The Gap or all kinds of choices, right, Kev? Right.
So there's like nothing in Russian stores that I could possibly buy. And there did exist these things called hard currency stores, which were, you know, just a few of them around Moscow. And they would not let regular Russians in, only foreigners with, quote, hard currency, dollars, pounds, whatever, could go in these stores. And then you could go in and they were full of like, you know, fancy European goods. So I bought like a whole new suit and tie and whatever to wear while I was there at this store. But that was the only way you could do it. So it was this incredible time of, there was a country that was on its last legs. I mean, it was a deprivation for the people who were there. I mean, of course the high officials had whatever they wanted, but you know, if you wanted to buy a car, you'd get on a 15-year waiting list and things like that.
Well, and so take me back if you can, Kev. So you show up, your luggage is lost, you've got to deal with this problem. But as you're dealing with this, of course, you're dealing with native Russians and you're there and you're witnessing the environment around you and you're seeing people. And so what are those first few moments and then first few days of kind of soaking in, okay, what's actually happening here?
It was an amazing lesson. I would walk around. You read in those days about long lines because people hear that some store got shoes in, and that kind of stuff. I actually went. There's this famous department store that's still there on Red Square called GUM. GUM is spelled. And I remember going there and walking around and being like shocked that this is the Macy's of Moscow, and there's nothing on the shelves, but maybe like cheap plastic toys and, stuff nobody would want to buy. I mean, it was quite an incredible sight. And by the way, when I went to this convention center where they held this thing that I went to specifically to go see, it was mobbed. It was absolutely mobbed with everyday Russians who were walking around with big bags and scooping up as much of these like little toothpastes and deodorants and powders or whatever, facial creams, anything they could get their hands on because they couldn't get these things. And it was, little things, right? Like I remember at one point having to go to the bathroom. And so I go into the, this is a convention center that, hosts major conventions, whatever. So I find a bathroom. I walk in, and there are no doors on any stalls. There are no seats on any toilets. There is no toilet paper in any roll. There are no towels and any, I mean, this is like, this is what life was like at that moment in time.
It's funny. I'm laughing a little extra hard because we recently did an episode. With Sean Riley, who is the co-founder and CEO of Dude Wipes.
So, oh, God.
So I'm thinking, as you're talking, I'm thinking, what? And no Dude Wipes either, I bet. Huh?
but a great market for him to go to with that.
Yeah, if you could get in. And so what's it like as you're sort of this, you know, you're this young journalist up and coming. You've talked your way. I mean, this is the story of yours. And of course, it sort of swizzles in and out of the novel. We'll get to some of that too. But this experience you've had, it sounds like you're telling me a Hollywood story, up and coming young journalist for, you know, USA Today then was like a very significant media asset in our country. And
it was on a rocket ride at that point. Yeah.
And obviously you're American. And so you've lived a life of abundance and here you are. And sort of, are there early conclusions you're drawing, or how are you processing this experience, particularly over the first few minutes and first few days?
So the flip side of that was this feeling of a tremendous amount of hope. There was hope among the people that were there, the Muscovites, the Russians. I mean, they felt like, I'm sure there were like, they're always in a time of change. There were older people who were like, what's happening to my world? You know, this kind of thing. But generally speaking, there was this tremendous feeling of hope and acceptance and welcoming. I just generally was embraced as an American. Oh my God, we want to talk to you. We want to hear about it. What's America like? What's, you know, how, and we want to be friends. I mean, that was generally the reception that I got everywhere. So here's another story. I can't remember if it was that first flight over or the second time I went over, but I'm flying over and I'm on the plane and I'm sitting next to this guy and I start talking to him. And it turns out his name is George Cohan, and he is the biggest franchisee in Canada of McDonald's. And so I'm meeting him on the plane, right? I have no idea. I didn't know any of this, but basically he's flying over to Moscow because he's in the process of building the first McDonald's, the famous like Moscow McDonald's that opened in 1990 on Pushkin Square.
And you just serendipitously are sitting next to this dude.
Serendipitously, absolutely.
As a 28-year-old USA Today reporter working this big story, you are seated next to the dude who's about to open the first Moscow Mickey D's.
Well, at the time they were still building it. So it opened in 1990. So this must have been maybe 89. And he invited me. He said, like, you know, come over. I'll tell you the whole story. I'll show you the place. So I go to this building that they've now like hollowed out and are starting to, starting to renovate. And he was telling about all the machinations they had to go through to even try to do this and how difficult it was. But, you know, there's also these stories about how he goes like, I don't know. You know, I think this must have been some kind of KGB office or something, because we actually, a couple of times we knocked down walls and found human skeletons behind them. I don't know what kind of ghosts are going to be in this place. So I ended up, that was actually a big, great thing for me, because I ended up now staying in touch with them and being able to follow the progress of this. And I went back for the day that the Moscow McDonald's opened. It was the largest McDonald's in the world at that time. And if you look, I mean, you could go on YouTube, for instance, and Google Moscow McDonald's opening and see these videos of lines that were like a mile long and people just being like amazed at this food that they were able to, you know, get in this McDonald's. I remember this one thing. I remember being there and watching this woman who had no idea like what to do with the Big Mac. And she opened the package and the Big Mac sitting in front of her. And the way she ate it was she ate it one layer at a time. Like she took the bun off and ate it, took the lettuce off and ate it.
I mean, if you didn't know, maybe that's what you do, right? I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but of course we already know the answer.
Right. So it was, you know, it was an amazing adventure. And again, like things like that, like the opening of the McDonald's. I mean, it was all full of this incredible feeling of hope and friendship and what the future could possibly be.
And would I be wrong in saying that Mikhail Gorbachev had a lot of elements of some great leaders that led, you know, peace movements, that led movements to open their societies up, like, you know, the mythical Gandhi or the, you know, the mythical Mandela, of course, the founding fathers. Like there was a lot of that, or directionally that he felt like at the time, if I remember.
I mean, look, some of it was practical in the sense that, you know, he obviously understood that the Soviet Union was, its economy was in the tank, and it couldn't compete with Western economies. And, you know, it couldn't, outlast, in a military conflict unless we went to nukes or something like that. And I think I'm sure he was just looking around him at the way the world was unfolding. By this time, China was opening up to the U.S. too. I'm sure he and his folks around him realized they didn't have a lot of choice either.
Yeah, but we all know that history has societies that were crumbling or failing in one way or another, and their leadership didn't exactly get hip to the reality and try to peacefully, in an organized fashion, in an orderly fashion, transition, as opposed to going kicking and screaming, which would have been an option, right?
Right. No, that's right. That's very true. So I was, talk about this idea of hope. And I've always been, in one form or another, a technology journalist, author, whatever. That's always been my thing. So that's, aside from the broader implications of business and the economy, I was very interested in technology stuff. And so I sought out, as one of the things that was happening at the time was, as Gorbachev sort of loosened things and allowed things to happen, there was a period of time when essentially, like, they were allowing things to happen without making them legal. And so it was technically illegal to start a company at that particular time. But for the first time, there was kind of this nod and wink of like, you know, all right, we're not going to come in and shut you down if you do this.
And so, ta-da, a new category called Russian entrepreneurs sort of begins underground and then bubbles up, right?
Right.
That's very exciting, right? I mean, the creativity, innovation, the hope.
And I learned something over there, that there was actually a value to Russian computer software guys at that particular moment in time. Because prior to that, if you would go to school to learn software and coding, but the machines you had to work on were like generations behind anything the U.S. had at that time. And they couldn't get their hands on any, you know, American or European actual, you know, computers or PCs or whatever. And so Russians learned to do a lot with code in a very little amount of memory. And this actually became something that was an advantage to them once they started to connect to Western companies, because they were these brilliant programmers.
Because they were forced to compete at a world-class level with nowhere near the capability.
Right.
So they had to figure out
how to do something
exponential and creative and, you know, out the box and dot, dot, dot.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you go and you open your refrigerator and it's full of all sorts of food and ingredients. It's easy to make something nice for dinner. You open your refrigerator and there's like four things in there. You got to start figuring out how to be really creative with what you're going to make. And so these startups started popping up. And now I want to tell you this story, Chris, because it both gets at the sense of hope at that time and also what could have been and what was lost because of who came next was Vladimir Putin. I ended up meeting one of the most memorable people I met there. It was this guy named Stepan Patchikov. And Stepan had started a company called Paragraph, That was in Moscow. And at the time that I visited him, it was already, he had been up and running for maybe a year. So he already had 120 or so employees. And they had started out by making software that could recognize handwriting, or that was the goal, to make software that could recognize handwriting. You remember Apple's Newton?
I remember it very well.
Of course.
I remember the first time I saw it demoed.
Apple went around the world looking for software that could recognize handwriting, because that's what it wanted the Newton to be able to do. And the most advanced version of that that they could find was the one that was being made in Moscow by these guys, these programmers at Paragraph. So Apple contracted with Paragraph, you know, which was still an illegal company, to buy their software to use in the Newton machine.
That must have been one of the very first things along those lines to occur between a U.S. tech.
It had to have been.
Right.
And so I wanted to go meet these guys. So I go over. I remember going, walking down the streets of Moscow, which were like, you know, buildings are falling down. There's like nothing in storage. You're walking along. And all of a sudden I get to this alleyway. And there are stacks of Gateway 2000 computer boxes. And I'm going, what the hell is going on here? And I go in, and sure enough, there's this, you know, almost Silicon Valley looking like operation, you know, in this building. And now where I'm going with this is that, so Stepan starts this company, and I wrote a story about him, and I have the story still. And I actually did a Substack piece about it. And I remember the quotes he's talking about, how, you know, he wants to build this company in Moscow. He wants it to be a Russian company, a great Russian software company, and sell to the West and all this stuff. Well, fast forward a couple of years.
This is what he tells you.
Yeah, this is what he told me. That was his intention. He wanted to help build a new Russia.
He knew exactly what he was doing.
He knew exactly what he was doing.
He was an entrepreneur who was going to create something of massive value in the West and beyond, Russian software. And he was gonna show everybody what was possible.
Exactly. That was where his head was. Fast forward a couple of years, and Putin comes into power. He starts to reverse all of this, and Patchikov ends up realizing that he has to leave. Either his business is going to get shut down, or he's going to be arrested. So he packs up and he moves the company to Silicon Valley. So eventually, he ends up selling Paragraph to another company. I forget what the transaction was or who bought it. But
at that point, Paragraph's an American company?
He moves it to Silicon Valley and starts it in, I think it was Sunnyvale, and turns it into an American company.
So he threaded the needle.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then Stepan sells this company, and we stay in touch. I keep like talking to him, writing stuff about what he's doing. Maybe a year after that, I'm at a tech conference. And I'm walking down a hallway, and I see Stepan sitting on the floor. And this is the time when we had flip cell phones with cameras. He's sitting on the floor, and he says, "Here, come here. I want to show you this new thing I'm working on." And he shows me how he can take his camera, and he can open the flip phone and take a picture of something, and it will save it in the cloud. Cloud wasn't much of anything anybody talked about then, right? And tag it and be able to find it again. And I said, that's amazing. I've never seen anything like it. What are you going to call it? He said, I'm calling it Evernote. Stepan was the guy who founded Evernote.
That's incredible.
But I tell you this, I tell this story because like Russia had a chance to have this guy
right
in their camp. And I mean, think of what he would have done for the country if he'd been able to build, you know, two or three different software companies. That would have competed, yes, with the West. And instead, he ends up having to leave because of this other regime comes in and says, that's not what we want Russia to be. We're going to shut it down and, you know, have a kleptocracy. And instead, he becomes a value to the West. And this is, you know, the kind of thing that was happening over and over again.
Well, and the other thing, look, it's easy to be cynical, and there's lots to be cynical and pessimistic about. And the reality is, when Putin took over for Yeltsin, had he followed on the path of hope and the path of more creativity and innovation and obviously freedom and equal rights and the things that we hold dear, or at least some of us, then the positive side of this as well, Kev, to your point about the McDonald's guy, would American VCs start investing in entrepreneurs in Russia? Would it have been possible? If you look at what Tel Aviv and Israel more broadly is, it's only second to Silicon Valley in terms of tech startups and value creation in that regard. And of course, anybody who knows anything about that, as you well do, knows that the Israelis have done it masterfully because they often co-locate the companies. And so they've created a collaboration and some competition. I mean, there are absolutely Israeli companies that compete against American companies, but the two ecosystems are deeply connected and in a very positive way. Well, the reality is, you're right. The Russian talent's amazing. And if that had been possible, we would have built deep relationships. And, you know, would Microsoft would have wanted to have, you tell me, 50,000 Russian engineers if they could?
Oh, I'm certain of that. And there were a few investors already starting to poke around. You remember, you know, Esther Dyson. Remember Esther?
Yes, I sure do. She's an icon, and
she is an icon.
Incredible.
And she was one of the first to recognize the opportunity there, and she started to make trips over and invest in companies, and the VCs were definitely interested.
Right, there were evangelists talking about this.
Yeah,
it seemed there was a time when the Russian education system was tilting heavily towards STEM stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Russians were known for having great engineers.
Exactly, yep.
And I mean, you tell me, but was there any kind of tech company of consequence prior to the attack on Ukraine that didn't have some kind of an operation, or at least a third-party group doing something? Or like, if you're in the software business, tech business, you probably had some kind of Russian connection, if not operation. Yes?
Yeah. And, you know, and I mean, again, if you think about what could have been, you know, I mean, none of us use any Russian-built technology. You know, Tetris came out of Russia back in the day. That was
legendary.
Legendary. And, so the biggest success that I can think of that I knew about in Russian tech circles was a company called Yandex, which was is kind of their Google, Facebook rolled up in one. And even there, like, I think the story was that because it had partial Western ownership or something, Putin ordered the company to be sold for half its value to one of his oligarchs. And
excellent thinking.
Yeah, so like, you know, it's just not possible to have that kind of a business there.
I also want to ask you, tell me a little bit more about when and why you stopped going.
So this period of time, and again, we can get back to this, but that is what I tried to capture in the novel, because it was just this crazy, chaotic, you know, you didn't know the good guys from the bad guys moment in time, when, you know, you had this economy trying to shift from communism to capitalism. Capitalism is still semi-illegal. The top people in, you know, governments have no idea how to work capitalism, but they want to try. And, you know, KGB agents are getting, you know, KGB is getting dissolved. So KGB agents are becoming like new business executives, and they're still operating like KGB agents and all this crazy. And the Russian mob, you know, it's kind of a lawless time, and the Russian mafia types are the ones that are starting to take charge and build restaurants and businesses. It's just nuts, right?
Yesterday's villain is today's vicar.
Yeah,
right?
It is. And it was, yeah. And it literally was. I mean, I remember you started really not knowing if, you know, am I here interviewing a good guy or a bad guy?
And were you fearful, or how did that feel?
Well, so yeah, you know, the first few trips over, and I remember not feeling fearful at all. And then it just step by step started to get weirder and weirder. And And I had a couple of colleagues that was also going over covering the political side of things or whatever else. And we were, you know, we were talking, like we started to increasingly feel like somebody was going into our hotel rooms when we weren't there, you know, or, you know, we'd get asked to go, like, I remember some being taken to a restaurant that was in this outskirts part of town and wondering, like, where am I being taken? And, you know, who am I actually with? And when am I going to come back? And then finally, I think it was probably 1993, one of my colleagues, a guy named Taylor Buckley, went over and he was doing some reporting there. And he's walking down a street and a gang, you know, jumped him and beat him almost to death. And we never knew at USA Today. And we, you know, we tried to find out, but we never knew who did it. We never knew if it was just a bunch of street thugs or if it was actually some, you know, government people or who knows, police, whatever. We don't think it was just street thugs because for the most part, we were always greeted, you know, very nicely right. by the average citizens, right?
I mean, the obvious question, I'm sure you've thought a lot about this, had Taylor written something that could be viewed as negative and they wanted to, quote unquote, teach him a lesson? Or
Taylor was a brilliant, fun feature writer. And I those were the kinds of stories he was doing. But USA Today as a whole, you know, other people were doing stories sure. that maybe the More government critical. Would have been unhappy about.
Yeah.
And you know, probably didn't know who was who. And
just he's the USA Today guy, and we're going to teach USA Today a lesson.
Maybe.
Because the likelihood of a street gang beating up a journalist who I'm assuming didn't have a ton of money on him.
Right. I mean, it didn't seem that he was being robbed.
For what reason would a street gang just do that?
Yeah. Didn't seem he was being robbed.
Yeah. And so after Taylor was so brutally attacked, you decided that was that?
Yeah. And by that point, I had had enough weird incidences that...
What kind of weird incidents?
Well, like I say, like going back to my hotel room and thinking, like, things seem a little out of order. Hmm. I think somebody was in here while I was gone. And
you can even feel a little creepy, you know, when the service comes afterwards because, you know, somebody's been in your room, even though they did a wonderful thing.
Right.
Yeah, it's weird how you can feel that.
Yeah, yeah. And so there was...
Do you ever feel like somebody was following you or you were being set up or...
Yeah, there was a couple times. I remember walking through this street market and I wanted to buy some, you know, odds and ends to take home and turning around a couple of times and thinking like, I swear to God, somebody keeps following wherever I'm going. And I, you know, just, you just have that feeling, right? I mean, I couldn't tell for sure, but it just increasingly felt like that. And then Taylor gets beaten and I just went to my editors and said, I'm done. I'm not going back. And they basically, I think the paper just said, we're not sending anybody back for a while until we figure this out.
And, I mean, not to be overly dramatic, but the obvious seems to be the obvious, which is you must have given some thought to, flip of the coin, Taylor or me.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, like literally luck of the draw.
Yeah.
Quite literally.
Yeah. Yeah. And by that point, I had my first kid was born, like, you know, in 1991. You know, I wasn't going to risk that.
Well, no. Even without a kid. Now, I just looked on the Wall Street Journal's site, and it looks like Evan, the journalist who was taken in Russia. It looks like, let me see. I think this says, 11 months. And so, you know, how do you experience that? Or what lens do you see that through?
Well, I guess there's sort of two sides of that. Is one is that, I mean, certainly it's easy for me to read those stories and go like, wow, everyone could have been me back then. But then the other side of that is that this is just such a completely different time from then. My danger was probably going to come more from some rogue person or you know, Russian mobster or something like that, the government wasn't after us, you know, in the same way, or trying to make a point. There wasn't a strong man like Putin in charge. You know, Putin, you know, there was Gorbachev, then Boris Yeltsin. Yeltsin, as he stepped down, put Putin in charge, but it was you know, just a very different atmosphere and time. But yeah, I know. I mean, it's easy for me to read about him and go like, what if that would have been me? And how, I can't even imagine what his conditions are, he's, you know, having to deal with at the moment.
And as a journalist, we hear a lot about what can happen to journalists in various environments and how there's supposed to be this rule or law that we sort of leave the journalists alone. And of course, that's not what happens. And so there's a lot of discussion every year about journalists that are killed in conflict and that have horrible things happen to them, and
yeah,
or that go to jail because they won't reveal sources, or, you know, these are things I hear on a fairly ongoing basis. You've lived all of that or a lot of that.
Yeah.
So I'm curious how that all looks through your eyes.
Yeah. I guess what way I'd put it is I was also never that brave. I was never one going to be one who was going to volunteer to go into a war zone or, you know, a place where I really wasn't going to be wanted. I just didn't want to do that. Wasn't in my DNA.
Well, there's brave, and then there's, why would you do that?
But journalists do that. I mean, look, yeah, I have a lot of respect for the ones that do. The people who go into war to cover war zones and stuff. I mean, I can't imagine doing it, but I have the tremendous amount of respect for the people who do. And so glad that they do. You know, I mean, it benefits all of us.
And absolutely. And does your experience, Kev, give you a different lens, or what are your thoughts on where Russia is today? So much hope was lost. And so how do you think about it today?
I don't know how that country becomes a great European, Asian, you know, country that, you know, competes with the West without, an enormous amount of reform to what it's doing. I mean, Putin has to go, you know, it has to stop being a nation that's dependent on scarce resources. You know, I mean, its economy is dominated. If you look at the list of the biggest Russian companies, they're all oil companies, mining companies. This is what the economy is based on. And that is a 20th century, if not 19th century, economy.
He literally chose scarcity over abundance.
He did. And look, the story of Stepan Patchikov is an illustration of that.
Right. He was an abundance creator.
Yeah, he was an abundance creator. Right. So
right. It's like, at some level, it's really fucking simple.
Yeah.
When human beings collaborate, we create abundance. When we fight over scarcity, we kill each other.
Yep, that's right.
I mean, it's kind of that simple.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't even know. I mean, I'm not a political analyst and don't really want to get into, you know, Putin and you know, of course, we just saw, you know, Alexei Navalny getting murdered, and you know, I don't know. I mean, I would look, let me put it this way, having experienced what I did experience, even though it was a long time ago, I would love to have an enormous amount of hope for that country and those people. And I would love to see it become a vital player in the world economy. I just don't know how that's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, wouldn't it be amazing if we had a relationship with them like the relationship we have with Japan, or
yeah,
the relationship we have with the vast majority of Europe, and et cetera, et cetera? Yeah, that would be fucking cool. Abundance.
Well, so if I could talk, you know, a bit about what I tried to capture in the novel.
Yeah, and I also want to talk to you about sort of what possesses you, who's written, how many books have you written, Kev?
Well,
business books?
Published nine business nonfiction books.
Yeah. Okay. And of course, legendary career as a reporter, writer, but like most writers, there was a point in time where there was a novel being worked. And for some reason, in more recent times, this novel has come back up.
Yeah, exactly.
So cool. As you walk me through, also sort of think about, you know, back when it was being created and why it has come back now.
Yeah. Well, as I was in the middle of all this, and I was witnessing so much interesting, almost unbelievable kinds of stuff. And I thought, like, you know, I always wanted to write a novel. And so here I was 31 years old or whatever by this point in time. And I thought, well, this, you know, would be a great setting. I could use all these details of all the things I've been reporting on. I could, use Moscow 1991 as a setting for a novel. So I cooked up this idea of, you know, a young person at that, about my age at that time, was working.
Shockingly good looking. Yes. Keep going.
Was working for a management consulting firm and not really sort of getting anywhere and feeling like, you know, a little lost, and start seeing news reports about what's going on at McDonald's, with McDonald's opening in Moscow and all these other things. And gets convinced that he's going to go try to go over to Moscow and, you know, make his fortune. So he travels over, in a reflection of things that really were supposed to happen then, he was supposed to go over and meet this one business to work for them. And then this other business basically kidnaps him, something that really actually did happen, to try to convince him to work for them instead. And he gets caught between these ex-KGB guys running one business.
See, that's just not a recruiting technique that is used enough in America.
Yeah. Yeah, we want that guy as our CTO, and he's not. Let's just go take him and bring.
Let's go get him in his jammies while he's not paying attention.
It's a new kind of headhunter.
Exactly.
And then in the midst of this, because he's a management consultant, he just keeps getting thrown into these sort of businessy situations where I get to describe this crazy stuff that was happening. And just the crazy stuff that was happening in life. And, you know, he ends up getting caught between these business run by KGB guys and this other business where these young, ambitious Muscovites who don't know what they're doing. He falls in love with a girl and the other one. And, you know, somewhere by the time you're in the middle of this, like I was explaining, you don't know who really are the good guys or the bad guys. It gets all mixed up. Look, readers of Play Bigger will know that. I like to try to keep it light and funny. And so hopefully it's funny and, you know, yet full of these cool details.
I'm reminded you'd come out for a jam session at the very beginning of the project. And the first thing you were going to go ahead and write was, the introduction. And I remember opening my inbox and there it was, and I opened it up and sat there and immediately read it. And I was completely captivated, Kevin. And at the end of it, the very first thought I had was, holy fuck, the whole book's gonna read like that. And when we began to understand that you were using so many techniques that are in a novel, the way you introduced us. Oh, we're reoccurring characters in a story. That's what he's fucking doing.
Right.
Okay. Right. It's yes, absolutely a business book. And so it makes a ton of sense to me that you've now written a novel. You do it every time.
And you're right. Exactly. And I've always brought novel-like techniques to any of the business books I've written. But to finish answering your question is that I actually wrote a draft of this novel in 1991. And I had never, that was before I published any other books. And I didn't know what I was doing. I sent it to a couple editors, didn't hear anything. I figured like, well, I guess, you know, this thing must suck or whatever. And I stuck it in a drawer where it sat for 30 years. And then I was having a conversation with my now grown daughter, the one who was just born when I was writing this in the first place. And she's like, I want to read it. Where is it? I'm going like, well, I think I wrote it on WordPerfect on a floppy disk.
Anybody have a floppy disk reader around here? I don't know. Let's go down to Radio Shack and see if we can.
But I think I have a printout somewhere. I did find the printout. It was like one of those printouts with like the little holes on the side and the, you know, they're all attached together.
Yeah. What were those printers? Daisy wheel, I think, right? Yeah, dot matrix daisy printer thing. Yeah.
So I pulled it out and I'm going like, okay, well, first of all, 30 years have passed. I had very little memory of like what I, you know, the story was like very little. So I pulled it out. I figure, well, look, I'm going to read this before I let anybody else read this. And I get like, you know, 10, 15 pages into it. And I'm going, I have a reaction like you had when you read the introduction. I'm going like, who was this guy?
This guy might have a career in writing.
This is pretty good. And so I read the whole thing and I'm thinking like, I could do something with this. And I send it to my daughter. My daughter, Allison, lives in England and she's a magazine editor there. So she's got the same, you know, genes. So she reads it. And first thing she says is, you know, Dad, like, this is really good. You should do something with this. And the next thing I know, she sends me 2 pages of notes of how to make it better. And so she was right about all of it. And I took the whole thing, went through it again, you know, doctored it up. And you know, it turned out, I think it turned out great. And it's gotten, you know, some great reactions from everybody that I've had pre-read it. And now it's about to come out.
It's so great, Kev. No, it really is. It's great. Because it's a stunning piece of work. It is so strangely timed, right? Because it shows what could have been.
Yeah, exactly.
It was so close to being.
Yep. So this turns out to, I mean, it kind of turns out to be an historical novel. Now that was written, first draft written in the middle of the history.
And, right, so it sits in a different context for all of us.
Exactly. And now it is a story of something that came and went, that could have tipped in very different ways. In fact, the end of the story, there's a hopefulness about this, you know, this business continuing and actually building something. You know, and that's where the mindset was in 1991. And I don't think you could write, I don't think you, I or anyone could sit down in 2024 and write that novel.
Well, the awesomeness about that, of course, is the vibrance of the detail and the experience is it's happening in real time. And a buddy of mine, Colin, used to have a career as a professional photographer. He still does a little bit, but he used to say that, and I think somebody taught him this, but he used to tell me, because he would teach me techniques and stuff just with my phone and shit. And he said, photographers lead more vibrant lives because once you become a photographer, you notice things that you might not otherwise. Like, for example, I said to him, he gave me clouds. I never really paid that much attention to clouds. And he loves taking pictures of the clouds, and he does an amazing job. Anyway, the thing I have subsequently learned is the exact same thing is true for writers. you know, you're walking down a gravel road and you're sort of in your head, you start going, he was walking down a gravel road, right? Like it starts going off, right?
No, that's right. And you know, when you're there, you know, you're there for your job, for a newspaper, magazine, whatever. Part of what you want to do with your writing is bring things alive, make them very vibrant. So you do. I mean, you notice everything. You look at everything. You try to record everything. You know, I carry around your little notepad and write down the little details. And of course, there's no question that helped, you know, writing the novel. I mean, there's all these tiny little details. I have this whole scene set in a Russian refrigerator factory that is incredibly vibrant in explaining how fucked up the economy was at that time, because piece by piece you get to see how crazy this factory is put together so that it can never possibly be efficient. But I was able to do it in this sort of entertaining way.
Kevin Meaney way, yeah.
Details are drawn and you know, you place people in the story and what their motivations are. So it's that kind of thing that I was able to draw on for this.
Yeah, it also, frankly, I think gives people more empathy for Russians, because it's probably a lot like that. I was thinking today, our dishwasher is 11 years old, blah, blah, yada, yada. Ta-da, we got a new dishwasher today. And the dude came over, super professional. It was awesome, right? And the new dishwasher looks great and everything's awesome. And that's relatively simple. Dishwasher starts breaking down. Talk to the fix-it folks. They say, probably not. Da, da, da. Might as well invest in a new one now because da, 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 blah, blah, blah. Great. Who should we talk to? Da, da, da. Google around. Blah, 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 blah. Call some folks. Bada bing, bada bang. Oh, and they take the old one away.
Yep.
Excellent. We don't miss one washing of dishes. And so you're reading stuff like this, you hear stuff like this, and you go, holy shit, which gets me to a point. Not that Russia was ever a democracy, of course, but there was real hope that there was going to be a whole new level of freedom and agency and creativity and et cetera. Yep. And so the other reason I think this book is timely, Kev, is, and again, I don't want to sound overly dramatic, but I also think we need to pay attention, that freedom is fragile. Hope is fragile. And we do take a lot for granted, particularly around how we treat each other in our democracy.
Yeah, I know.
How does it make you think about sort of those sorts of threads?
Well, exactly what you're saying. And look, I've always loathed to get too political, but you know, we are looking at a situation this year where there's a possibility of our country going in a direction that heads more towards where Russia is than towards, you know, the kind of country that we have had for the past 100 years. And I don't think that's a steep cliff to fall off. I mean, you know, you look at history and countries can pretty quickly fall into a place where we don't even want to imagine. And I'm not so sure that that's not possible as we go forward here in the next couple of years. So I don't know. It does worry me a great deal.
Yes, me too. And what's super concerning is, I think I read the same polls that you do. Actually, I saw one today. 70% of Americans don't like the choice we're given. Mm. Right? Because, and again, I don't want to speak for anybody, so I'm just synthesizing what I consume, that a meaningful number of people on the right want the policy and direction, directional things that they want, but they want it to be a little less, let's just say chaotic or a little less exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And but then the problem on the left, of course, is the left in our country has gone so far, it's outrageous.
Mm-hmm.
right? I mean, open borders, there's a disaster in Afghanistan, DEI gone mental, you know.
Yep.
And so it feels like the I don't know what percentage to put on it, so maybe I won't, but the smaller percentage on the further extremes suck up a lot of the oxygen and it's exhausting. And the vast majority of us don't like either choice.
No, that's right. I mean, that's that's probably like 70% of the people.
That was the one I heard today. It was 70% of the country either man.
You know, most people are somewhere in the middle, and we don't want to be governed by people on the extremes. And unfortunately, that seems to be what's happening now. And, you know.
That's right. Most people are for women's rights to choose and reproductive rights. And most people don't think that you should be having an abortion at the 9th month, right? So, okay. Yep. I don't know whether the answer is, but like most people are reasonable on these sorts of things. Even those, you know, they say, are you pro-life? Oh, no, I'm not pro-life. And I go, huh? I'm pro-life as hell. Really? I don't want there to be one abortion, and I want everybody who's alive to have a happy, successful life. I think an abortion would be a horrible decision for, I know women, I'm sure you do too, most of us do. If they talk to you about it, they tell you this is not a fun thing. They take it very seriously. But I also think we have no business telling them what to do. And anyway, my point is most reasonable people can get to some, of course, we're all pro-life. We don't want one, but when it needs to happen for whatever reason, then let's, you know, kind of be reasonable and move the fuck on. Like, and most of them are like that.
Yeah, I agree.
Most people don't want a fucking open border, and most people think we should be a benevolent society and create opportunity for those who legitimately need it and meet the criteria that we decide is the criteria. I came here as an immigrant. Now, is immigrating from Canada and Mexico or Latin America the same thing? No, of course not. And we can't just fucking let hundreds of thousands of them in all the time. We don't even know who the fuck they are.
Right.
And most people would agree on these things, right? That's the thing that's crazy.
Yep, exactly.
And even if we disagree, like I have some very right friends and I have some very left friends. And you know what? I would trust them to make decisions about my life. Okay, so we disagree about this or that on the margin. Do I know they're good people? Anyway, you got me going.
Yep. I agree.
And so the book's kind of like reading a movie,
because
that's the way Kevin Manning writes. And so is it going to become a script?
Well, I don't have the power to make that happen, but.
Well, you could convert it into one.
Yeah. But in terms of getting somebody interested in it. But I'm going to try to get it.
I don't know what the garbage that gets greenlit.
I know. No kidding.
And the other thing, you know, I thought about it from a movie perspective. I mean, I haven't read the whole thing, but I read the piece you sent me. And I couldn't help but, as I was reading it, feeling like I was seeing a movie in my head. And I thought, wow, I don't know shit from Shinola about making a movie. But I thought, you know, if I was a director, if I was a set creator, designer person, if I was a costume person, and even if I was an actor, vivacity of the writing... I just made that up, verbosity, of the writing. It's so vivid. It makes it sort of feel that way, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Well, I hope so. That would be my dream, to have it, you know, converted like that. And look, I mean, that is...
I heard Francis Ford Coppola was looking.
You know, the proudest works I've done, the book Play Bigger, as you said, you know, there's a lot of elements of how it reads like a novel unfolding. My other proudest, you know, accomplishment was the biography of Thomas Watson, the guy who built IBM, which I totally approached
from absolutely a movie.
Yeah. And I approached it from, you know, day one as I'm going to write a biography that reads like a novel. And I got 5-star reviews in every, back when the Times and Wall Street Journal and places like that actually did book reviews, you know, all saying that it reads like a novel. That was one of the most biggest compliments I could get. So, you know, I want to continue to, you know, hopefully this is not the last one. I want this to do well enough to give me permission to do another one. And this is what I'd like to do.
Well, I don't know if this is a good idea or not, but the interesting thing, we are living at a radical exponential inflection point. I mean, we're going from the first or the last native analog generation to the first native digital one.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, today there's AI. Al and I were talking about this the other day with our buddy Flip. You just think about the way we live today. Right. So you're on your way to the airport. You've already checked in on your smartphone and you're on your smartwatch, and your smartwatch or smartphone is your ticket. And then you go through this incredibly advanced technology that x-rays you naked. And then you get on the plane, and then you're on the internet, and then your Uber gets notified when you get there, and you just sort of start thinking about, okay, if you take that stuff away, and some of that stuff is 10, 15 years, right? And say 20. When does the iPhone come out?
2007.
Okay. So there you go. Of course, and we had all the internet stuff, but the iPhone took it into the world because of the mobility, obviously. Anyway, the point being, wow. Radical change in mm-hmm. incredible, like more change in the shortest period of time that's happened. Now that will likely increase, but still, it's a pivotal time.
Can we? We maybe running out of time, but I want to hit on that for a second, because you and I actually talked about this in an episode several years ago.
I agree with us.
No. After I wrote the book Unscaled with Hemant and Asia, and one of the things the sort of grand historical sweep that we were looking at in that book, and we were a little ahead of our time. It came out in 2018, I think. But we've made the point that there was one other period of time that was something like this, and it was roughly 1890 to 1920. In that period of time, that was when the automobile, the airplane, the telephone, a whole bunch of things were invented all at one time, right? This incredible burst of technology. So that life in 1890 was completely unrecognizable by 1920 from 1890 to 1920, and that set the whole 20th century in motion in one sense. But also, if you remember, what also happened is, because there was like this tremendous change in technology, was changing society and changing geopolitics and changing balances of power. And what do we have during that time? We had two world wars that got started, you know, in the wake of this tremendous technological change. So fast forward to somewhere around 2007. I would put that the marker, because the iPhone comes out, introduces the world to the, you know, cloud and mobility, and by this point the internet's vibrant, and soon after we start creating AI and 3D printing and blockchains and gene editing and all these other things. That what we wrote about in that book was that we have this probably 30-year period of technological change that is similar to that period of time. Times 10, and that life, you know, 30 years hence is going to be completely unrecognizable from what it was before. But if you put those two things side by side, it's not that surprising that we have this moment of turmoil in the world, because there's just this great technological change that's changing society and changing balances of power and technological and geopolitical maneuvering. And I think the world could be in for more of this as we go through this time. But the good news is that when we came out of the other one, we ended up with this, you know, this 80-year period of incredible prosperity, where we created a middle class, we created, we doubled lifespans. We did all of these things that are some of the most amazing achievements in history. And so if we can get through this period of time and adopt to all these technological changes and not blow ourselves up, I think we stand the chance of creating another, you know, long wave of historical benefits to human beings.
Hmm. I agree completely. I also, as you're talking, I just pulled it up so that I could actually have it. Artificial intelligence is the future, not only for Russia, but for all mankind. It comes with colossal opportunities, but also threats that are difficult to predict. Whoever becomes the leader in this sphere will become the ruler of the world, Vladimir Putin.
Wow. Okay.
That's what he said about AI several years ago.
Interesting.
Yeah. Like this looks like 2017, he might have said it. Anyway, so it feels like that.
Yeah.
We should sit down and have a whole conversation about what are the learnings from then? And are we heeding them now?
Yeah.
That would also be a great book, by the way. Or certainly a great Substack, if not a great book. All right, Dr. Maney, anything else?
No, I think I'm tapped out.
That was great. Yeah, that was really great. Thanks, Kevin. And thanks for writing your new novel. It's really very cool.
Yeah, thanks. Well, thanks for having me on. And it's always fun. I mean, whatever we talk about, it's always fun.
We always have a great time.
That was the legendary Kevin Maney. You can find more about Kevin at kevinmaney.com. And make sure you pick up a copy of his new book, Red Bottom Line. Don't forget, podcasts make great gifts. Share two podcasts you love with two people you love. And make sure you follow us today on your podcast player of choice. We'd like to thank you. We appreciate you investing part of your life with us. Are you feeling overwhelmed by endless tasks? Hand them off to Bottleneck Distant Assistance. Their dedicated remote professionals take the weight off your shoulders, handling everything from admin to analysis with excellence. Why stay bottlenecked when you could soar? Hire your dedicated distant assistant today at bottleneck.online and refocus your energy on what really matters, affordable support that lets you work smarter. That's bottleneck.online. Your website is the first thing people see about you. So, is it legendary? Well, our friends at Atre.net have been building preeminent B2B websites in Silicon Valley for over 20 years. If you're in a B2B tech company and it's time for a rapid relaunch of your site, then visit our friends at Atre.net. That's Atre.net. Are you ready to learn the greatest superpower in business? Category design? Well, that's where the Category Pirates come in. Learn how to create different futures, design and dominate markets in the first business newsletter written for and by pirates. Go to CategoryPirates.com today and get your button gear. Today's information is provided to you solely for informational purposes. This oddcast is the sole property of the Lockhead Oddcast Network, and it contains content known to the state of California to cause radically non-obvious thinking, new categories, and exponential results. All oddcasts contain nuts, all rights disturbed. Please contact your doctor, lawyer, accountant, yoga instructor, shaman, and category designer before doing anything about anything you hear here today. Warning, in California, drivers blocking traffic in the left-hand lane by law can receive a $269 fine. So please, don't be lame. Get out of the passing lane. Everything is the way that it is because somebody changed the way that it was. This episode was produced and edited by me, Jason DeFilippo. Sarah Knox and Jamie J handle the website and technical execution. Show notes by GM Simon. RJ and EX Bobus do our web development. Cedric Biros does our graphic and web design. Our law firm is Weed and Jack. Our accountants are Three Balance Sheets to the Wind. We record on squadcast.fm. Joan Jett was right. Listen to The Tragically Hip. Thanks, Candy Dandy. And hey, Colin, this oddcast really ties the room together. Our deepest apologies go out to Sam Bankman-Fried. You may have only gotten 25 years, but we'll still never have time for you. Till next time, stay safe, stay legendary, and follow your different.